We have yet to understand exactly the ways in which we don't have control over it, because we are still trying to play whack-a-mole and fix things one bit by bit.
Are we losing control of our technology? Welcome to Tech First. My name is John Kutzier. Our guest today is writer, technologist, and software engineer, and author, recent author, who's previously worked at Google and Microsoft. His name is David B. Auerbach. He's the author of Meganets. The full title is Meganets: How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. That's a mouthful. Welcome, David.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Hey, super happy to have you. Let's start with the question that the title begs. Are we out of control with our technology?
I think we are, to a much greater degree than we expect, or that we think, or that our experience has led us to believe. Because I think you see this in the constant either scandals or just mishaps that occur across the board in highly networked systems, whether it's the cryptocurrency crash, whether it's just the unpleasantness of social media, whether it's the recent AI fiascos that people have been somewhat unsettled by. My thesis is that there's actually a common root to all of these things. It's not individual technologies running out of control, but that actually there is something deeper going on, and that what we are seeing is a broader loss of control stemming from the combination of hundreds of millions of people interacting with huge network systems constantly and in a way that's faster than any of us can keep track of.
So I want to dive into lots of different parts of that, including AI systems that are black boxes and we don't understand how they work and how they come up with an answer and why they don't work in some cases and do work in other cases. But maybe let's situate ourselves historically first. How is this qualitatively different than in the past? Let's say a pre-digital past where, you know, everything is kind of always out of control, right? I mean, there's no nations and companies and people, and somehow this teeming masses all kind of sort of works or fails, right? How is this more out of control now?
Well, we can say that that something new has been added and it is out of control. And in fact, the analogy I make is that, you know, rather than treating these technological systems as, you know, based on algorithmic recipes that we can just debug, it's better to think of them like the weather. The weather is a classically chaotic system that, you know, we cope with, but nobody thinks that we can actually control. But in some ways, so is the global economy. The principles of laissez-faire economy entail ceding a certain amount of control, and, you know, magically self-organization seems to happen. And that's true of these systems as well. But that doesn't necessarily mean, just as with capitalism, that doesn't guarantee you that the self-organizing principles are necessarily going to be beneficial. Some of them may be, but some of them aren't. So I think what we're looking at is we have this entirely new realm in which we have lost control in a way somewhat similar to other realms that we already are accustomed to a lack of control in. But we have yet to realize it, and we have yet to understand exactly the ways in which we don't have control over it, because we are still trying to play whack-a-mole and fix things one bit by bit. So that's a very good question. And it's, again, I think we used to have more control over computer technology. Even when Windows was crashing, you know, every day, those things could actually be fixed eventually. You know, it was a bit of a pain in the butt, but yeah, the possibility still exists to track these bugs down and squash them one by one. And Windows did indeed get better over time. You know, it did get more stable. If you compare Windows 3.1 to Windows 95 to I guess, NT and XP were, I think, when sort of actually been approached something stable, there was that progression. I don't think you're seeing that with today's network technologies. You aren't seeing a progression towards stability. And that's the difference, we can say, and even within the digital realm.
In fact, are you seeing a progression towards instability?
I think we're seeing a progression towards greater complexity, and that does bring a greater degree of instability with it. Now, that's not to say that these systems may not stabilize, but they may not stabilize in ways that we particularly like. If we want to see a stable version of, you know, a toxic online media ecosphere, nobody wants that stability. So I do think that even when it comes to something like cryptocurrency, there's a certain amount of instability baked into it because you just have the latitude for sudden viral floods of actions in one way or the other. You're even seeing this in the traditional stock market when people buy up GameStop and extend it soaring. And there's no explicit collusion or anything. It's just people are able to coordinate and exchange in a networked, feedback-driven way that wasn't possible before.
That is a fascinating example. I'm in Wall Street Bets, which is the Reddit forum subreddit.
That's there you go. Yeah. You were at the heart of it with, who was the GameStop guy? I forget his name.
I forget the names as well, but I see
write
it.
About him in the book. I write about him in the book actually. So I'm gonna find this because it's an amazing story. Yeah, that you are part of some conspiracy to artificially inflate stock prices, or maybe you can correct me that you are. I don't know.
Or maybe but it's a different kind of conspiracy. It's just an agreement out in the open. Anybody can see it. Hey, let's do this.
I would say that actually makes it a not conspiracy. One of the people who endorsed the book called me an anti-conspiracy theorist. I think that's it, is that there's nothing too nefarious going on, or at least there's much less nefarious stuff going on than we'd like to think. What's actually happening is there's just too much chaos. And, you know, and this is what the SEC ran up against this. They were saying, well, there's nothing, people aren't actually doing anything illegal, but you can see that they're unhappy about this. It's like, we need to stop participation.
How dare the little guy win? Yeah. How dare the little guy win? We have a system here. We have rules. We have investment banks. They're supposed to win.
Very much so. Yeah. Well, I think the attitude is they're messing with the system. Even if you don't win, you're messing with it. You know, it's like stay out of our turf.
Wall Street we can't is a history of messing with the system in order to make money off of things that are not socially beneficial to anybody except the people who take the tens of millions of dollars in bonuses.
Indeed. But, you know, they are doing God's work, as some people said. Keith Gill, that was his name.
Say again.
Keith Gill, also known as Roaring Kitty on YouTube. Yes. I write about him in the book because he testified before Congress as this, like, just all shucks guy and just said, like, well, I just like the stock. And it didn't seem like a performance to me. It seemed like, yeah, here's a guy who's like an insurance adjuster or whatever, and he's doing his thing. And what's crazy is, you know, I don't think it's not like he's going to be the center of things in the future. It's just that these phenomena can now pop up, become viral, and then fade back. And the next one, you don't even know where it's going to be. So by the time you close the barn door on one, the next one's already happened. And that's the sort of lack of control that I'm talking about.
From 15 minutes of fame to 15 seconds of fame, perhaps in the internet age, who knows? So
15 seconds of chaos.
Yes. So that's perhaps one example. Perhaps Silicon Valley Bank failing, the biggest bank failing in decades at least, is another example. I'm not entirely certain. Let's get into some specifics of what you see as impacts of us losing control of technology. What are some other scenarios that have happened that you see as examples of that?
Well, the cryptocurrency one is a big one that, you know, to some extent, a lack of control is baked into it. But some of the phenomena we're seeing are certainly not what people intended. And the in some ways, it does serve as an analog for these systems more generally, in that they are consensus-based mechanisms. They make it explicitly harder to have top-down control unless you control, you know, a major amount of the currency or processing power. But I don't think that cryptocurrency is so far off from how these systems work more generally. And you're getting to this point where you could see a crash, something like in 2008, except you're not, a bailout isn't really going to be possible because the money is just, well, I don't know, maybe it'll be socialism today because you'll just have to give money to all sorts of random players. I don't know. But you know, it actually, I think it's going to pose bigger problems than what we saw with Lehman in 2008. And that wasn't exactly popular with everybody either.
No.
But now that you're seeing, you know, last year, obviously, there were a number of crypto crashes, scandals. You had the play to earn cryptocurrencies in the Philippines, where people, store owners during COVID were just sitting around playing this game, playing games all day, making, you know, virtual cryptocurrencies and hopefully cashing them out because it's completely crashed now. But you saw this complete crash of lots of currencies and NFTs. You saw the particular collapse of those so-called stable coins, Terra and Luna. Even more so, the FTX Sam Bankman-Fried blow up, which was especially interesting because that represent, you know, those, the people doing it were the children of old school elite economists.
Yes.
So that should tell you what direction we're moving in. And there's too much money there for banks and investors to ignore. So the crypto economy is being integrated into the larger economy, and it's going to bring that level of destabilization to things more broadly.
So
I can give you another example too, but that's another big one.
Let's go to the other one, because I'm wondering about crypto, if that isn't just an, first of all, hype cycle and a bubble, a tulip bulb craze, plus a ton of grift and a ton of just financial malfeasance and cheating and everything like that. But I see that if you integrate that into the ordinary economy and you get some of that chaos there as well, That can be a challenge. What's the second example you want to bring up?
The second one was actually the recent AIs and how they are talking about releasing nuclear codes and how they love you and how they're having nervous
breakdowns. More than your wife.
Yeah, that's right. And in that case, what I wanted to, it's because of how they act, it's tempting to think of them as somewhat autonomous, discrete entities. They aren't. They don't mean any of this stuff. They don't even understand what they're saying. They're very convincing, but they don't mean it. They don't understand any of it. What they're actually doing is reflecting the collective dreams and nightmares of what's fed into them. And that is why it's similar to these other systems, in that it is actually the actions, the uncoordinated and sometimes coordinated actions of many, many people that actually determine what these AIs put out, not the programmers and not some brain inside the AI, because that doesn't exist. It's much more that what we see, what these AIs tell us, is a reflection of our collective conscious and unconscious. And why does it spin out such scary fantasies? Because if you ask it for scary AI stuff, it's going to draw on what it's been fed. And that in turn will cause people to write articles about scary AI fantasies, which will get fed into the next iteration of these chatbots.
Yes.
And that is a similar feedback loop to what you see with these other things, where you get these feedback cycles of, okay, everybody's getting in on GameStop, everybody's piling on someone on social media, everybody is suddenly talking about Elon Musk, that it is a similar feedback-driven effect. It's just that with AI, it's not as obvious because it appears to be sort of generating this out of whole cloth, but it's not.
What interests me around large language models like ChatGPT and others like that, obviously they're interesting inherently, and what they can do, what they appear to be able to do is frankly, in some cases, amazing, in some cases, game changing. I've seen, for instance, the CEO of a drone delivery startup actually ask ChatGPT to create code, which was then used in some of the systems, literally. I mean, after being checked by a software engineer, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just insane stuff that you could not have imagined maybe 20 years ago or something like that actually happening today. What interests me is that it's getting easier to train these large language models. And we can't assume that Google, Microsoft, maybe Apple, and others, OpenAI obviously, are the only ones who have them.
No. Absolutely not.
We see Yandex is working on them. Certainly Chinese startups are working on them. Question is, there's so much malfeasance on the internet, ad fraud and other things like that. Very high level, high tech criminality. What is going to happen when some criminal organization trains one of these and actually gives it arms and legs in the real world, so to speak? of the internet gives it free rein.
I don't think there's any stopping that. I mean, if, you know, if I run a cult, I want to set up a chatbot that that is fed on, that's trained on, you know, particular things that may draw people to my cult, I can do that. And, you know, technology,
and
because
we've
of technology
seen,
miniaturization, I don't see any way you're going to keep this out of the hands of just anybody, not just like, you know, states or other states or shady corporations. I think, you know, anybody's going to be able to train these things. It'll take some
and
doing,
your cult
but the
example
incentive
is interesting.
There.
Your cult example is interesting because we've seen how emotionally engaged people get with AI systems. There's an example, I forget the company name, but they created an AI companion. And they recently took out,
three weeks ago,
the ability for it to talk dirty. I don't know exactly the details, but basically get sexual, essentially.
Right.
And that is causing huge angst among a subset of their customers who
They're traumatized. Yeah, they feel abandoned. Replica, right?
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, they even name themselves Replica. I mean, it's just like, it's just like, you think that would scare people off, but apparently not.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I draw the, people got attached to their Tamagotchis, those little virtual pets, and those things were incredibly primitive. So from my perspective, there's absolutely no limit to how attached humans can get. And I don't think, and there's going to be such a demand for it. I mean, I think people will want that to feel that the way that they make it feel to such an extent. No one's going to ban it. And it's going to change because, as I said, they do not feel in the way that we feel. But if it makes people feel good anyway, well, maybe we don't need the human emotions we feel. Maybe, you know, our concept of love is outdated. But I think that that's inevitable. Yeah.
So
because it appeals to, you know, human need. Did you ever play Farmville back when that was a big thing?
My kids did, yes.
Yeah, those things were great at sucking money out of people because they didn't want to see your crops wither. Well, imagine, you know, that's a pretty primitive way of pulling on people's heartstrings. Imagine what we can do once you've got like language models, as well as video generation, face generation, video generation, body generation. You're going to see fairly convincing virtual people in a fairly short time frame. Not
imagine
just
that
and voice and appearance.
Imagine that in the hands of the types of people who scam lonely individuals out of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, whether that's elderly people or whether that's people who are looking for love in all the wrong places and get scammed. Imagine that technology being able to do that at scale with a unique face, a unique.
Well, yeah, it's like Glenn Ross, except with robots, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Okay. So I can also see, in terms of being out of control, some of the technological systems that we're building are too complex for any one individual to understand and comprehend. And in many cases, teams of individuals as well. And then we're actually setting those up and those are colliding in real time on the internet and engaging. And it's hard to know what the outcome of that might become. What are some safeguards? What should we be doing about this?
Well, as I said, trying to fix things in a targeted way, you're always too late. By the time you're aware of it, it's already gone. So what I advocate in my book, MegaNets, is more softer, non-targeted fixes to not censor, but to do things like rate limit and enforce heterogeneity. Because what you're seeing also from recommendation engines, you know, it's not these incredibly complex algorithms, which are evolving constantly. They aren't guaranteed to do the same thing a second later because they keep getting new inputs from all the people that are working on them. That they tend to cluster like with like. They're giving people what they want. Well, sometimes giving people what they want may want a little less may actually be good at decoagulating and slowing down the sort of viral rampages that we see. Because I think what we're looking at, there's three qualities that I talk about. There's volume, the sheer size, velocity, the sheer speed, and virality, by which I mean the sort of feedback loop where things build on themselves. And since you're not going to be able to stamp out the bad instances one by one, even Facebook admits they can't. What did they do in the run-up to the 2020 election? They banned all political advertising. That's not a company that can actually keep track of their data, right? No, I mean, I just feel like this is something that, you know, has been acknowledged, right?
Yeah.
But that sort of less targeted mechanism, you know, they said, oh, you can't forward a link to more than 5 people. Well, that'll certainly do it. Now, I don't know if those 2 particular mechanisms are good ones, but I think that's the sort of direction we should be looking in to say, okay, look, there's going to be a certain time lag introduced before in terms of how much things can be forwarded. We can try to sort of get more disparate content mixed together. I think TikTok is doing something like that. They're trying not to recommend quite such tight matches because I think teen girls were getting too many pro anorexia videos, things like that. So that's the direction I'd like to see us go in. And I think there's a lot of room for experimentation there. But so I'm not going to say that there's one approach that is guaranteed to work. But what I can say is that what people are complaining about and asking for now isn't going to happen, and it hasn't been working, because I don't think most people would say that things are getting better. So we need to change the question we ask, which is not how to eliminate the bad stuff, but how can we make it so that the potential impact of it is slower and more moderate.
2 things come to mind as you're talking there. One is, there's a small town in California that has banned people from coming because there's amazing hills and fields with wildflowers, and it got popular online, and they literally were inundated with hundreds of thousands of visitors last summer. Tourism is great, dollars are great, but totally destroying a town and actually destroying the thing that you came to see by hundreds of thousands of people walking out to be surrounded by the wildflowers. They severely clamped down on how many people could come by limiting parking and all this stuff, right? That's one thing. That's sort of a chaotic outcome of algorithms that's feeding human behavior. The other is, and I forget what country this is, but there was literally a genocide that was driven by WhatsApp or Messenger and Facebook in the past few years. I believe it was in Africa or Asia. I'll find out later and I'll put it on screen. I don't know if it's ringing a bell to you, but it's literally something that was forwarded string long via WhatsApp, I believe. And so Facebook has tried to do some things to limit that as well. But it's amazing how the algorithms that we've created define the best have really limited the range of experience. You go to Yelp and you say, oh, what are the best restaurants here? And you go there, you have a horrible experience because it's crazy busy and everybody is there. It's like we're afraid to, you know what? Let's just try something. Go somewhere.
That's the thing is that the systems, I mean, what are algorithms going to do by definition? They're going to try to make matches. So unless you're actually explicitly putting things in to actually degrade them, and I guess what we can talk about is an algorithmic degradation, you're going to see it try to say like, okay, here's more of the same. Here's more of what I think you want. Because these recommendation engines, all they can do, even in AI, what's it going to do? It's going to give you what you want. And I think what we're seeing is that giving people what they want, as our capacity to do so increases, the problem of giving people what they want becomes more apparent in many, many contexts.
I don't even know if it's what people want, but it's what we're kind of hardwired for. We're kind of hardwired for newness. We're kind of hardwired for controversy. We're kind of hardwired for, you know, something to get passionate about, and that can be exploited in certainly social systems, search systems, recommendation engines, and stuff like that. Maybe gaze into a crystal ball for us and look forward a few years. I'm not confident that we're going to find ways along the breaks that you're suggesting we put on systems and everything like that. What's the end state here? What's the end game? What do you think will come crashing down?
Crashing down or just the changes? Because crashing down, I think you will see more instability economically in particular, because you're going to see more things like the GameStop, like the Wall Street bets, except on a bigger and weirder level. I think cryptocurrency will have a greater impact there as well. So you're going to see more things happening with or without just the dishonesty of something like FTX. But it, so societally, I think what you're going to see is, again, yeah, the creation of narrative bunkers in which people of who share the same opinions, who share the same way of thinking about things, are looped together. And instead of fighting with other groups, they aren't even aware of them. So you're going to get an increasing number of small microcultures that are going to have a hard time even understanding one another, because people will develop their own language. And I think if you look online, you know, the amount of jargon that every subgroup has, and the amount and the performative role that it plays, you know, that we identify you by, oh, you're using the right words, you know, and this and these words, sometimes they're obnoxious to other groups, but other times it's just like, I don't know how to talk like this. I literally don't understand what these people are saying. And even in talking about my book to a wide variety of people, I've been amazed at how wildly different people have takes on technology. Some people see it in terms that are almost incomprehensible to me, or in ways that are so different from what other interviewers say to me, that it's as though we're talking about different issues. And I can't really think of, yeah, that's the lack of fundamental agreement, even on the framing of these issues. This is something that is fairly new, because we used to have a fairly unified top-down media environment that would set narrative parameters. There was still some room for argument or whatever, but everybody was speaking the same language. That's disappearing.
That does not bode well for peace and living together. We've seen an increase in violence, not just in language and in what people do online, but also in the real world, as we live in greater and greater different worlds, essentially, and those clash, and we can't seem to find a way to get along. That was worrisome.
Well, if there's any consolation, is that I do think that it will produce less clashing and simply incomprehension. People will simply ignore it. There are huge, I'm also amazed that I can talk about a particular meme or a particular phenomena, and there are a lot of people who've never even heard of it. There's just too much out there. So the fact that there's no sort of set of canonical, essential, or central signifiers to a culture now, basically, again, it's the atomization of culture into a lot of narrative bunkers and microcultures. And the effects of that may ultimately yield less conflict and more just simply a sense of the world being incomprehensible as a whole, being impossible to get enough detached perspective to actually understand what everybody's doing.
Which is a political tactic in and of itself, because if everything is incomprehensible, if everything is too complicated, then we just throw up our hands, say whatever, and then powers that be can do what they will and do what they wish. But also the challenge, I think, is that it's not just in the digital realm that we have this atomization of culture. Eventually it hits the ground. Eventually it's in the world.
Absolutely. It already is. I think that in that regard, this is an example that I cite in the book as well, which is that it's not that the powers that be have lost control. It's sort of devolved onto a little bit of power has fallen on each of us. We can't do much with it because we're only feeding into these massive machines. But the powers that be can't set narratives the way they used to. So maybe that's a comfort in that when you look at the parties today, something like Brexit was a lot less a matter of the powers that be than some people may have seen. It's not that the attitudes weren't, but you have these things tend to run out of control. So if the powers that be were running it, they would get achieve their objectives through slightly less messy and slightly less more efficient ways. Mm-hmm. So I think you are looking at the fact that in the, you know, the lunatics, that everybody's a lunatic, are running the asylum, that it is harder for the powers that be to actually take advantage of this. And in New York, in the New York mayoral race, there's actually, I think, less positioning, and effectively the least unacceptable candidate won, because there was so much chaos and so much inability micro-targeting, because we had moved to ranked choice voting rather than just like vote for your favorite candidate. Polling became impossible, so the candidates themselves were at a loss and just sort of said their spiel. So I don't know if you want to take heart from that, but a loss of control can, in fact, it applies to all of us. Well, you know, the powers that be are losing control as well. So,
you know, nobody wins in chaos, or maybe the strongest survives, but it's a nasty, brutish and short world. So, there are real challenges there. I want to, you know what we never did? We never defined MegaNet, and I'm going to read your definition here of a MegaNet. MegaNet is a persistent, evolving, and opaque data network that controls, or at least heavily influences, how we see the world. It contains both algorithm and AI-driven servers, as well as the millions upon millions of users that are frequently or always active on those servers. The result is an ongoing feedback loop that causes MegaNets to change rapidly and unpredictably in proportion to the three qualities of MegaNet content: massive volume, high velocity, explosive virality. That means quick change, unpredictable change, sometimes good things, sometimes awful things, and things that are increasingly out of control.
Yeah, and I hope that sums up the things we've been talking about. That is my view of it. And that was, you know, when I came to understand it in that way, I felt that a lot more things made sense, and that this feeling that I feel like a lot of people
nothing have. Makes sense, because everything makes sense, because here's the unifying principle. Everything everywhere all at once.
I at least have a framework in which I can understand why I and so many other people are feeling this loss of control, and that understanding is at least the first step to taking what action can be taken.
It's interesting as well, because that we talked about it impacting the real world. It's making changes in the real world at a speed that you would never, never, ever see. Just one example, in the past 6 months, an obscure government report comes out that gas stoves may cause cancer in young children, may be unhealthy. Boom. A month later, you have a law on the books in Florida that they're tax-free. It's like, wow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there are people who definitely try to take advantage of these things, but even they are limited to the extent in which they can push one thing or another. That one hit big. Other things did not. I've seen, you know, there have definitely been other things that try to get pushed around, like it was a future in which no one could leave their town. Everything would be local.
Like,
it was
it's the 15-minute town concept, which ideal. I think it's from Europe somewhere or something like that, which is basically everything you need is close. So you don't have to travel super far for work, for groceries, for entertainment, for blah, blah. It was a really good thing in a sense. And of course, some conspiracy theorists said, hey, well, they're making a new law. You can't leave your town.
Right. Exactly. So I got spun up into that. That one didn't seem to hit as much as the gas stoves, though.
It was too stupid.
It wasn't for lack of trying. You know?
No.
And that's the thing, is that even if they don't blow up to that extent, they still have their adherence. And I still see people mentioning
they still 15, have their
15
adherence.
Minute town. Yeah. And that's what's going to happen, is that that you're seeing all these more subtle changes that are affecting people. There are going to be a small but not insignificant number of people who hang on to that 15 minute town. There's no sort of ecological and pruning and natural selection of ideas. People can hang on to them and reinforce them.
And
that contributes to the atomization as well.
Exactly. And here's the problem. As you have that continued, just entirely different sense of what the world is, what reality is, what the baseline principles and foundations of our lives are, as that totally shifts, you get people who believe that something that somebody thinks is innocuous or not a big deal is an existential threat to their lives. And then they start showing up at places with guns. And the U.S. has a lot of those. And there you get problems. We have to bring this to a close. I really do appreciate this conversation. I don't know if we understand more, but maybe we understand a little bit more.
I hope so. I hope so. Understanding is good. Some understanding.
Exactly.
Even, the limits of our understanding are good to know.
We'll have to design a super AI to understand it all for us. Thank you so much for your time, David.
Thanks for having me, John. It was great.